Okay, I'm going to call the Senate State Affairs to order. Today is Thursday, April 5th, and the time now is 3:31. Members present, we have Vice Chair Geisel, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilson, and Senator Egan. So we have a full committee. And with us as well, Christine Marsegan, my staff, and Senate Records, Chris Dickrow. And behind me is the LIO monitor, Doug Bridges. Okay, so on today's agenda, we have three items. Senate Bill 159 is the PERS TERS distributions. House Bill 47 is the municipal PERS contributions and interest. And House Bill 152 is organized militia. So first bill we'll take up, if there's nothing to come before the committee before we get started today, we'll take up Senate Bill 159. The State Affairs Committee heard this bill on March 20th. I believe Commissioner Riedel presented this. I don't know if she's here or is anyone else here. Okay. And we may have some questions or did you want to make any additional comments from the administration? Please come up here and join us. We may have some questions for you. How's that? And if you wouldn't mind putting your name on the record, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Lee. I'm the Chief Pension Officer and Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And I'm here to answer any questions you might have about our bill.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. And this is on Senate Bill 159, right? Is that
yes? Right.
Yeah, okay. I don't know, for some reason it shows a location Galena on here. I think that's the next bill.
I think that's
okay. Is that that's the next one, yeah. No problem. We'll Senator Geisel, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Ms. Lee, will this bill have any effect on our unfunded pension liability that continues to grow?
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, no, it will not. This bill deals with moving the distribution options that are available to participants at termination from statute into regulation so that the plan can have better flexibility in offering new options or changing options at some point in the future. Any of the distribution options that have a cost to them, the cost is borne by the participant.
Senator Geisel.
So as I'm reading the fiscal note here, it refers to authorizing a lump sum payment of the entire balance or a periodic payment option authorized by the regulations. And that's what caught my eye, the lump sum payment of the entire balance. That seemed like kind of a balloon that might cause that bubble in the snake to pop up in terms of our unfunded liability.
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, this is a defined contribution plan provision. So there is no tie between it and the unfunded liability in the defined benefit plans. And
thank
the lump sum that's being referred to here is the participant's account that contains their contributions and the employer contributions made on their behalf.
Thank you. That clarifies it perfectly. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Senator Geisel. Senator Coghill.
So I appreciate that because I think the distribution methods can change from kind of one generation to another. Do you anticipate that you would follow the kind of the principal structure of the statute as they are, or what were some of the flex points that you see that were immediately needed, just out of curiosity?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, we have no plans on changing the existing options, but we the ARM board, as well as the Department of Revenue, Treasury Division, and the Division have identified a need for more robust spend-down options for participants. And these spend-down options that we've investigated, we've seen eight presentations on different options. they don't fit into the current definitions.
Yeah, now I remember what the Arm Board suggested. So I was looking for the principle of operation, but it was really based on the Arm Board's recommendation. I just had to have my memory jog, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had a lot of bills since this one. Senator Coghill. Additional questions? I think you've answered mine as well. So if there's no other questions, I think we did close the public testimony on this, haven't we? Or did we not? There was none. Okay, so we'll open it to public testimony. I don't see anyone online, though, to testify. So is there anyone here in Juneau that would like to testify on Senate Bill 159? Okay, seeing, hearing none, then we'll officially close the public hearing on Senate Bill 159. Is there any additional committee discussion? I think my thoughts are that this will give them a little more flexibility without having to wait for us to come into session each time they want to make a change. But Senator Coghill?
Do those of us in Tier 4 have to declare a conflict on this? No. I'm in Tier 4, so I think I would appreciate the flexibility.
Okay. Additional comments? Okay. Well, there's no cost, no fiscal note, or zero. So with that, Senator Giesel?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill 159, version 30GS2815/alpha from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing, hearing none, then the bill will move from committee. So let's take a brief at ease. State where are we? State Affairs will now come back to order. Next bill is Representative Foster's House Bill 47. This is municipal PERS and contributions and interests. So if Representative Foster and his trusty staff, Paul LeBeau, want to join us at the table, appreciate that. And if you could, please introduce us to your bill and... looks like it's a fairly small bill, but maybe go through a sectional analysis, too, and then take some questions from us. So the floor is yours, Representative Foster.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee. For the record, Representative Neil Foster, House District 39, and HB 47 provides relief for communities who have lost 25% or more of their population in the last census. And so it does this by reducing their required payments to the PERS system. Galena, for example, lost 30% of its population in the last census, and this was largely due to the closure of the Air Force Base there in Galena. Municipalities must pay into the PERS system based on their current salary level, and at a minimum, they must pay based on what their salary level was back in 2008. Now, the rationale is that local governments usually either grow or they stay the same, but they don't typically shrink. And so the problem is Galena's salary level did shrink, and it shrank in half from $1.5 million in 2008 to $770,000 in 2012. But according to the PERS system, Galena has to make payments to the PERS system as if it still had a $1.5 million workforce. So Galena simply does not have the resources to pay into the retirement system for workers that they do not have. And so they're faced with two options. They can either let the amount that they owe grow, and currently that bill is over $1 million right now, or they can simply shut the doors and turn out the lights and kind of just close up shop. So we're hopeful that we can find a compromise with this bill. Galena would still owe for the bill that has been accumulated, but they would be provided some relief as they go forward. And so with that, I'll let my trusted staff, Paul LaBoule, maybe dive into some of the details here. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Thank you, Representative Foster. Any questions for Representative Foster? Senator Giesel.
Representative Foster, hasn't this bill gone through before, or has it never crossed the finish line?
It's gone through a number of times, and it has not crossed the finish line. I think this might be the first time we've made it to the Senate, actually. So each year we're getting a little bit better.
Yes. Okay, because yeah. It's a very familiar subject to me. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Seeing no other questions, Mr. LaBoule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if it's all right with the chair, I'd like to do a brief history before going through the sectional. As some of you at the table will remember, back in 2007 and 2008, we had SB 125 that pooled the PERS systems in the individual municipalities, which used to be siloed systems. Mm-hmm. And in that pooling, we required a 22% payment of their gross salaries. There was concern during discussion on that bill that what you might have with that system is municipalities laying off employees so they can put them out on contract, thereby reduce their contribution, and yet their liability remains the same, and it would distribute that to the rest of the PERS employers. A couple of different options were looked at for addressing that. What was settled upon was the 2008 floor, which is you have to pay it at the 2008 floor or gross salaries, whichever is greater. And existing statute also had the penalty payment for delinquent payments. If you didn't make the full payment, then it's 1.5 times the actuarial amount, or in our cases, 12% interest on delinquent payments. And that will bring us to the bill. Section 1 is simply cleanup language that is needed for implementation of Section 4. That the administrator is authorized to determine the rate of interest assessed under the statute referenced in Section 4. Section 2 is the portion of the bill that addresses the 08 floor problem. And what it does is put a new subsection under subsection A2 that allows for the payment or the floor to be reestablished for FY12 if the community has lost more than 25% of its population between the 2000 and 2010 census. Section 3 is conforming language, and Section 4 addresses the delinquent interest payment. That is at 12%. The current version of the bill allows the administrator to negotiate the interest rate for delinquent payments. We had, in several iterations of the bill, we had gone through different ideas of setting different rates. Deliberation led us to the conclusion that it's setting the rate in statute that's problematic to begin with. You know, administration would have liked to help them with their burden, but they're directed to charge 12% interest, and there's nothing they can do about it. So we give them the ability in these situations to negotiate that interest rate. And that's the bill. I would like to add one mention before we, if we get into the fiscal notes, before we get into that, which is the cost of not implementing the bill. Right now they have about a $1.5 million outstanding balance they owe the state. As that accrues, you run into different scenarios where the state could cut off community assistance, bar them from participating in certain revolving loan programs, and you could end up at a place where the city can no longer function, and bankruptcy is not an option for municipalities in the state of Alaska. And cities can dissolve, but they can't dissolve unless they pay all their debts. And if they could pay their debts, they would not be in the situation. So what that leaves them with is basically they could turn off the lights and, you know, give the keys to the state, in which case we would now be on the hook for the entire amount rather than paying on their current salaries and or the new established floor. Instead, the state would be on the hook for everything.
Okay, very good. Paul, how many communities does this affect?
Mr. Chairman, there are 5 communities that meet the population metric. It's Atka, St. George, Pelican, Galena, and
Anderson.
Yes. Of those, the actuarial analysis that we had last year cites only 3 communities that are affected, that being Pelican, Galena, and St. George. Though, according to the most recent actuarial analysis I had, St. George is not an ongoing issue.
Okay. And why would that be?
I think Kevin Worley from the department would be best to answer that question.
Okay. And if I may, what is the economy in Galena? I should know, right? But I don't, so if you can help me out.
Galena functions as a sub-regional hub, and there's also fishing. Their main economy used to be the Air Force Base, which is what closed down, which is what led to the population decline.
Okay. The reason why I ask is that, I know the with the military leaving, that's what caused the population to shrink, but do you see it ever going back up to that level? Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I could just add, they also have GILA there. It's the Galena Interior Learning Academy. And so there are quite a few students from around the state that attend the school for educational, vocational opportunities. So.
Very good. Thank you. And Senator Wilson.
Yeah, my understanding was that the Air Force left Galena with some assets as well, that some pretty substantial assets that they could also leverage just to also pay off some of these debts too. Is that correct?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, there were assets left. In terms of how much is an asset and how much is a liability, I know that we have people from Galena online. I think they would be best to answer the question. One asset that has been a major help to them is the Air Force left fuel behind, but it's not exactly something that they would be able to sell given the nature of transportation in rural Alaska. So they've been able to use that to offset their utility bills as they're transferring to biomass as a major energy source.
Thank you. Senator Wilson, anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. That's a good question. So what happened in the other communities? Why did their population shrink?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Pelican, I believe it was the closing of a processing plant, though I know we have Kathy Wasserman here, formerly of Pelican, who knows much more about that. Of the Anderson, Atka, and St. George, I am actually unclear what the cause of the population decline was.
Okay. Very good. Other questions? Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could talk about the cost of the state then and what the state's sort of is on the hook now with it, with the potential decrease from these other five communities paying into their portion of perks, would be wonderful, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
And if we could, Mr. Chairman, perhaps we should bring Mr. Worley up for this?
For the fiscal note? Okay, why don't we hold off on that for just a little bit? Senator Wilson, thank you for that question, though. That is a little bit of concern. I'm not sure we even have the current fiscal note, but we'll address that here in a little bit. If there's no other questions, then for the sponsor and his staff, why don't we go ahead and take public testimony? Thank you, Representative Foster.
Thank you. Thank you.
So online here we have Chandra Huntington from the city of Galena. Chandra, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Okay. If you could put your name on the record, please, and then proceed with your testimony.
Oh, my name is Shonda Huntington, and I am the city manager for Galena. Before I served as city manager, I served as a city clerk for 6 years. I was born in Galena. I grew up here, and I raised my children here in Galena. And I would like to thank the committee for taking the time today so I may explain the importance of HB 47 for communities like Galena that have seen significant population decline between 2000 and 2010. As you may know, the Galena Air Force Base closure was effected October 1st, 2010, but it was in the process for 4 years before that. The Air Force Base was the main source of employment for Galena residents. Not surprisingly, the base closure resulted in reduction of the population. In 2000, Galena had 675 residents. In 2010, we had 470 residents, representing a 30% decline. Galena was struck again by hardship in the spring of 2013 when an ice jam on the Yukon River flooded the city, leading it to a disaster declaration. In 2008, FOR, established by the current PERS law, exists to prevent a municipality from gaming the PERS system by contracting out work previously performed by municipal employees in order to avoid making ongoing contributions to PERS. The current minimum PERS contribution is based on the level of salaries that existed in 2008. The law did not account for the Galena's unexpected situation. It did not consider municipalities with sharply declining populations. HB 47 does not change the basic PERS policy, but rather recognizes the unusual situation. HB 47 affects only communities that suffer a minimum 25% decline in population between 2000 and 2010, like Galena. To put that in perspective, the 25% threshold will represent the loss of approximately 75,000 people from Anchorage or 8,000 people from Juneau. What would happen to Fairbanks if the population declined from 30,000 while at the same time seeing the foreclosure of Eielson and Fort Wainwright? The demand for municipality administration public services would decline sharply. So would the municipality's ability to provide those services, having lost the region's economic driver. HB 47, which moves the 4 year from 2008 to 2012 for the handful of communities that experienced these huge losses, does not provide a loophole allowing Galena or any other community with similar population loss between 2000 and 2010 to game the system now or in the future. Under HB 47, the 2008 floor for those few qualifying communities is replaced with a 2012 floor. The City of Galena's payroll has consistently exceeded the 2012 floor. Galena's circumstances are not a result of any choice the city made. The base closure and associate loss of close to one-third of the city's population was entirely involuntary. The relationship between a declining population and the declining payroll is clear. Fewer residents, fewer public employees equals lower public payroll. Based on the current 2008 floor, Galena is required to pay an amount owed by a city substantially larger than Galena. Galena requires PERS contribution approaches half of the city's entire current payroll. Galena's FY 2008 salary total was $1.5 million for 36 employees. Therefore, Galena's annual required minimum PERS contribution is $332,000. In FY 12, Galena's payroll was $765,000 for 17 employees. That's the year this amendment would move the floor for cities that saw a 25% decrease in population. Under the current 2008 floor, Galena's annual minimum PERS contribution is nearly half of the city's entire payroll cost. For the Galena, the difference in PERS contribution between 2008 floor and the FY 2012 actual payroll is $164,000. If not dealt with, this difference will continue going forward, creating an ever-increasingly obligation. HB 47 stops that from happening. The statute and any amount unpaid accrues at interest at 12%. This ever-increasing obligation adds unnecessary to an already stressed situation. The city's financial situation was so severe in 2011 that it required a low-interest loan to the Alaska Municipality Bond Bank to deal with severe cash flow crisis that was preventing us from being able to secure fuel for heat and electricity. Simply put, if Galena can't pay its bills, the lights go out in Galena. The existing 2008 floor is overall a sound piece of legislation establishing a sound policy. It does not account for all the situation. It does not account for cities that have suffered massive population reduction. HB 47 does not undermine the underlying policy of goals of the existing PERS structure. It helps ensure that municipalities are able to continue contributing to PERS while recognizing that a city cannot and should not have to make a contribution of a city that has significantly larger population. Recognizing that Galena is not the same city it was before the base closure and 30% of its population moved away, it is simply good policy that helps ensure that Galena can continue to contribute to PERS and that the lights can stay on. It should be noted that Galena has continuously paid its annual obligation of 22% towards PERS for its actual payroll. Thank you again for your time this afternoon, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Huntington, for your testimony. Are there any questions? Okay. Senator Wilson, did you? Okay. Ms. Huntington, Senator Wilson had brought up a question earlier about if there were some assets left by the Air Force Base when they left. Can you comment on that?
There was the million gallons of fuel that the Air Force left and to sustain the GILA, the Interior Learning Academy. That fuel was left specifically for the school. We're coming close to that term where the fuel is running out, and just recently the city had to take out a $4 million loan to upgrade the heat system and the water utility system that was left in poor condition by the Air Force in order for us to receive our AEA grant to install the biomass. So there was quite a bit of assets left behind with buildings, but they were older buildings that were, built in the 1960s. So there is quite a bit of maintenance that we have to facilitate now for them.
Okay. Thank you. And then Senator Wilson, follow-up? Okay. Ms. Huntington, can you stay online? We're going to just take a brief at ease. Brief at ease. Okay, the Senate State Affairs is back. Ms. Huntington, I don't know if you heard my question earlier about the economy there in Galena. Was there anything that Representative Foster's staff overlooked, perhaps? That is there any hope, or I guess, or prospects of the population coming back?
We always have hope here. We do have opportunities. You know, the biggest thing is the GILA, Interior Learning Academy. That has been taken over by, you know, the city and the school working with the Air Force Base. I'm hoping, you know, it can grow, but in order for it to grow, we have to do plenty of maintenance and repair to the buildings that were left behind and into the utilidor systems and all the utilities that were left behind by the Air Force because they are aging.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you. I don't see any other questions for you at this time, Ms. Huntington. Thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay, so we'll go back here to Juneau. We have Kathy Wasserman. Kathy, could you join us at the table, please? And if you could, put your name on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kathy Wasserman, Alaska Municipal League. This bill has been around for quite a while. We've been working on this for some time. AML and a number of other people got together a number of years ago and started drafting some legislation that would address the termination study issue in full. But as things got watered down because of we could see that we were probably not going to win that one. As we kind of watered things down, we eventually ended up where we would at least try to give some relief to those communities that were close to being underwater because of the under the floor issue. And Galena, I believe Pelican has paid off most of theirs. Their population drop came because the cold storage closed back in 2002, January 13th, if you want to be specific, at about 3 in the morning. So these were communities that lost population for reasons beyond their control. It wasn't that, and can the population grow? We all hope so, but, you know, under the circumstances, we're all dealing with financial crises, and I know in Pelican, there's ferry services down to nothing, and so all these things kind of pile up on each other. So some of these communities have a very difficult time in today's financial picture to grow and to attract people. So with these communities, I know that I try to speak to the communities on a, you know, each community on a monthly basis. And I know in speaking to St. George, I believe, and Mr. Worley can correct me if I'm wrong, that they don't have any more PERS employees, but, you know, there's a huge turnover in these municipalities out in the smaller communities. And I know at one point when I talked to St. George to see if there was a way they could, if we could help them put something together to pay their bills back, because I will no way advocate for a community that just fails to pay things. I mean, we need to offer them some help and advice at times. But and St. George made the comment to me that, oh, don't worry, we don't have any liability. We pulled out of PERS. And they sort of thought it was like a gym membership that, you know, if you just don't want to go anymore, you just don't pay, and it will go away. Meanwhile, their bill was ticking up at a huge level. And as you all know, St. George is a little teeny island on a little teeny rock way, way out there. And will the state ever be able to recoup those expenses? I don't see that happening. And at some point, I think there needs to be a discussion, and this bill is a good way to start things like this. What do we do with this? I mean, we can let it build up till it's the same as the national debt, but that doesn't accomplish anything. So this bill has always been a very good entry for keeping the subject on our minds and finding ways to solve it for some of these small communities that just can't pay this kind of thing and are losing population. I know that was rambling. That's why I should write things down, but I don't.
that's good. Thank you, Kathy. So I guess that bears the question then, if you deal with these five communities, will there be another five, you know, next year or 2 years, 10 years?
I can't say this, Senator Meyer, I can't say this with complete, I don't have numbers to back it, but I believe, because we've gone so far past SB 125, that just due to inflation and just the fact that a lot of these cities, even the smaller ones, are showing small increases, that we're getting further and further away from where this below the floor issue is as bad as it seemed back in 2006. And I'm sure that Ms. Lee and Mr. Worley have more information on that, but it just, I think this will eventually go away, but these people's liabilities, that liability won't go away.
And just for anyone listening, you refer to Senate Bill 25.
125. And what that was Senator Stedman and Senator Hoffman's bill on the PERS in 2006 out of Senate Finance.
Okay. Is that when we went to the defined?
Yes. That's it. Okay, yeah.
I remember that.
Uh-huh. We all do.
But I don't remember the numbers quite as well.
Well, that one I remember.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy. Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, we have charts in our packet here, PERS employer salaries for FY 08 through 16, and it gives employee counts. And I see where Galena at 2016 still has 19, it looks like, PERS employees. But one of the other cities highlighted was Nenana. They have zero. Pelican is less than five. I mean, I see where St. George has zero now. Mm-hmm. So I see where it's falling off. But Galena is still up there with 18, at least at the last data point here in FY 16.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. The five communities, is that the one with the most?
It is, of those, yes. And as Mrs. Wasserman noted, you know, St. George fell off. They actually came down to zero in 2010, it looks like, based on this data. So that might be why they're at zero now.
And Senator Meyer, if I might, you know, a lot of the communities have gone out of their way to not let go of employees because they don't want to trigger one of these. So hopefully, trigger some sort of a study. So that's always been a concern. I have communities call me, not as much anymore, but saying, oh, gosh, should we lay off so-and-so? Will we trigger a termination study? So a lot of them have put that off. And I think the need to stop that as more people come on to the majority of cities will eventually go away, I'm hoping.
Okay, I appreciate that. Anything else, Senator Giesel?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You know, Kathy, you may or may not be able to answer this. Why are we picking the time frame of 2000 to 2010?
Senator Meyer, I believe that's about the time we started this legislation.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. And
I was in my 30s.
And it is in the fiscal notes, so I'll ask when we get to that as well. Okay. Anything else, Kathy?
No, sir.
Any questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on this? Anyone here in Juneau? I'm not showing anyone off net. So with that, we will close public hearing. So there was quite a bit of questions, concerns about the fiscal note. If Mr. Worley can join us, please. And your name was battered around a few times, Mr. Worley. So, well, let's just speak for yourself now. So I guess first of all, there are two fiscal notes, and but I don't. One is doesn't appear to be current. Is that correct? Just one forthcoming yet?
Yes, sir. There's okay. The current bill that you have is the impact on the division, and there's no cost to the division. Okay. We were requesting an update to the actuarial numbers that were provided last year, since the numbers that were provided in the last fiscal note were from FY17. So as I was heading over this way, we just got the updated letter.
Okay.
So I haven't been able to update the fiscal note.
Okay. Very good. So I think the one I'm looking at is actually dated 2017, mm-hmm. The one you did last year when the bill first started, and it showed $121,000 for 2018, and then $112,000 for 2019. And you're saying those numbers will probably need to be adjusted?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, and then I was reading, again, I'm looking at an old fiscal note, so... but it did say that the bill modifies the 2008 salary floor, and it has to do with the 25% decrease in population between 2000 and 2010. And I guess my question was why those dates? And is it because that's when we started the process, or help me out here?
Oh, Mr. All right, to the chair. This is actually based on the U.S. Census. So between the census of 2000 and the census of 2010, those municipalities that participate in PERS that had that 25% or greater decrease, that was the the gist of the
that's why the
decrease.
That yes, makes sense. Thank you very much. And as far as you know, there is only the five communities?
To the chair, yes. We discussed this with Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, who provided a list of the changes in communities, and these were the five that were in PERS that were impacted.
Okay, very good. Any other questions at this time? Okay, let's see. I think I had one. Bear with me here.
No problem.
Okay, so I guess the only other question I brought this one up earlier was just if there could be other smaller communities asking for this same relief down the road in the future anytime soon, or does if we do this that's it? Won't have to do it again.
To the chair. This one is very date specific, so we're only looking at the two periods of time, 2000 to 2010. If communities again suffer this sort of decline from 2010 to 2020, I believe new legislation would have to be enacted in order to accommodate those. This will only deal with the five communities that are shown in our fiscal note.
During that time period of 2000, 2010.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I appreciate that. That is a little concerning because we do have a lot of small communities, and some of them have pretty fragile economies. Okay. Thank you. Any Senator Giesel, anything? Senator Wilson? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Worley. So I think with that, do you believe the fiscal note will be coming fairly soon? Sorry.
It's okay. Tomorrow I would expect the fiscal note to be heading over.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't we hold on to this until we get an updated fiscal note. Obviously, this is a cost, if we don't deal with it this way, we'll have to deal with it some other way. So it's kind of six one half dozen the other. So we'll wait then until you can provide us the new fiscal note, Mr. Worley. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And so we'll set this aside until we get a new fiscal note. Thank you, Representative Foster and Paul, for joining us today and explaining the bill. And Kathy, maybe this will be your retirement gift. Who knows? All right. So let's just take a brief at ease for now. Okay, I'm going to bring State Affairs back to order. We're now taking up House Bill 152, which is the Organized Militia Alaska State Defense Force. This is a committee bill, Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs, but it's being introduced and sponsored by Representative Tuck, and his trustee staff is here, Kenda Kloster. So, Kenda, the floor is yours.
All right. Kendra Kloster, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, and I also do a committee aide for the Military and Veterans Affairs. This bill is kind of a part of a series of bills for updating our Alaska Military Code. Our Military Code was in 1955, and we're just kind of starting to work on updating it now, so a lot of it has been out of date. So this is one of four bills that is going through the legislature this year to help update that code. House Bill 152 will help ensure the organized militia's four components, which is the Army Guard, Air Guard, Alaska State Defense Force, and Alaska Naval Militia, have an efficient military force to respond to the needs of Alaskans. A couple of the key parts of this bill is clarifying that the Adjutant General has control and command of the organized militia under the direction of the governor as the commander-in-chief. The TAG already, Adjutant General, possesses statutory control over the organized militia, but this bill will clarify command. Command and control are important functions in any military organization. Commanders are set for the responsible of the organization's priorities, goals, missions, while people have the authority to direct people to accomplish those missions. It's logical, however, it is not clearly set in statute, so this is one of the clarifications in House Bill 153. This will also ensure that the Adjutant General has the ability to adopt regulations as needed. It clarifies and lists that the Alaska State Defense Force may exist only with the express consent of the U.S. Congress. House Bill 152 will also streamline some of the day-to-day administrative matters. For example, the TAG can be able to accept resignations of commissioned officers or place the name of commissioned officers on a retired list. Right now it can go through the governor, but we're just moving that to the Adjutant General. This also relaxes the requirement for militia units to be served by an active armory. So right now, the Alaska State Defense Force we're working on, or the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is trying to grow that. Currently, in some of our small communities, it doesn't necessarily make sense to build an armory before we can have some of our State Defense Force members there. It's just not needed at this point, and it costs a lot of money to build an armory. So that part is being removed. There's a tuition assistance program for organized militia. We're adding the Alaska State Defense Force to that statute. We are not increasing the fiscal note or asking for any money for this. It's just allowing to make sure that all members of our organized militia are listed under there for the opportunity if money does become available for tuition assistance. And some of the changes that came out of the House, there was some concerns over parts of the bill which were removed, and that was imminent authority going to the Adjutant General in certain times. This was, and for example, I just kind of want to explain the history of that, of how we got to this version. In the first version, it would expand the ability for the TAG to call in the organized militia when the governor was unavailable. For example, if he was unreachable and we had another big earthquake and we couldn't get a hold of the governor, the TAG would have been able to call in our organized militia. At this time, they cannot do that. You have to get a hold of the governor. But there were a lot of concerns over that, so we removed that part. Going to go in more discussion on that. And so that was really the major change in the State Affairs Committee that was made. And with that, I am open for questions, and I believe I have Brian Duffy from Department of Military and Veterans Affairs on the line as well.
Okay. Very good. I'm sure it's in here somewhere. Is this at the – yes, okay. This is at the request of the governor that you bring this bill forward, or is this a committee bill?
Chair Meyer, this is a committee bill, but we've worked with Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. They actually brought this to us and said that this is something that they wanted to work on. They went through the governor's office and worked with them, you know, before they came to us as doing it a committee bill.
Okay, very good, yeah. Because obviously the governor, he or she, is delegating some authority to the general, so just want to make sure he or she is okay with it. So is there questions from the committee members? Do you want to walk us through the bill a little bit, a sectional analysis?
All right, so section one is where we are clarifying the control and command, as I described a little bit earlier. Section 2 amends the circumstances under which the governor may order the organized militia into active state service. For example, if the Adjutant General wanted someone to come in and work in their office directly, they can do that now within this legislation with their consent. Section 3 is whenever any portion of the militia is ordered by the Adjutant General, that decision is always reviewed by the governor. The governor's decisions are always final, but we're adding in that if anything that the Adjutant General makes a decision on, it can be reviewed by the governor since he is the commander-in-chief, so we're not changing that part. Section 4 clarifies existing law specifying the Alaska State Defense Force may exist only with the express consent of the U.S. Congress. Section 5 is just adding the Alaska State Defense Force to our organized militia definition. Section 6 establishes the TAG, and the Assistant Adjutant Generals are subject to regulations under the chapter and paid according to state law. Sections 7 through 9 that's the authority that we're going from the governor to the Adjutant General to allow the Adjutant General to accept resignations, added commissioned officers onto the retired list. Section 10 is the part I described where we're relaxing the authority to not have to build a armory when we want to expand the Alaska State Defense Force. Section 11 allows a TAG to authorize when funds are available for the tuition assistance program. We're adding in the Alaska State Defense Force to be part of that, so all four of our Air Guard, Army Guard, State Defense Force, and Naval Militia are eligible to be under the tuition assistance program. Section 12 specifies regulations adopted under the statute cannot be contrary to federal law. Section 13 directs regulations adopted under the statute must conform when governing by the U.S. Armed Forces. Section 14 allows the governor to delegate authority and provide a subdelegation except for the powers given to the governor to convene general courts martial. And Section 15 repeals existing statute, which is no longer necessary or amended because of the bills that are going through now.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that sectional analysis. I guess I do have one question as you go through the sectional analysis. In Section 4, lines 29 through 31, where it talks about members of the defense task for the state defense force performing inactive duty or training, it says shall receive benefits if they suffer an injury or disability. Is that new, or is that something we've always had in place? And is that a cost, potential cost to the state?
And we're looking page 2, lines 29 through 31, is that correct?
Correct, yes.
So this is also part of conforming language. We have another bill that is coming through the legislature, which is deals with that part. So it's kind of conforming language, and I will get to that part.
Yeah, I was thinking I'd seen that somewhere before. So it's in another bill that's working its way through the process?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's the pay and allowances statute, where it referenced 2605-260.
Okay. Yeah, I just was wondering if that would have an impact on the fiscal note. It appears not to, but I will ask Mr. Duffy's online, so we can ask him that question. Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Kendra? Or, I'm sorry, Cluster, right?
Cluster.
Cluster. Thank you, Ms. Cluster. Senator Caulfield.
First of all, I want to apologize for having to step out, Mr. Chairman, and no, this question may have already been asked, but under the Section 2, the organized militia may not be used against to mitigate our lawful activity, including organized labor. So is that something that is brand new as a policy call, or is this something that is conforming to policy call that's already with regard to organizing?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I believe this was the part that we actually moved it from one section to another, and then it was actually cleaned up in the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee where we added some additional language there. It's just ensuring that if there were, say, a demonstration going on of that sort, that you can't send out the organized militia during rallies or things of that nature.
That's interesting. What if the rally became unruly?
No.
That would never happen, right?
So it's just not.
It's okay. A lawful activity is what it's saying here.
Lawful, yes.
And I was just wondering if that was something that's already in statute and if it was a policy that has already been enforced and contemplated or if it was new, that's all.
Yeah, that Senator Caulfield through the chair, the Section 2 actually used to be much larger, and so I know we moved around a lot of language and some of the parts cleaning up the statutes as we're doing a lot of these different bills, and this one kind of moving some language around. I know we moved it from one section to another and then cleaned up that language a little bit, but a lot of Section 2 used to be much larger when we was removed in House State Affairs, though, so it made more sense at the time when there was a lot of stuff under there.
Anything else, Senator Cargill? Okay, Senator Diesel, Senator Wilson? Okay, we're all good. Let me welcome Representative Tuck. You came at the good time. Your trusty staff answered all our questions, and yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Cargill?
If I might just ask.
Absolutely.
And once again, my apologies. I was not here in your initial rollout. But in Section 15, you have a bunch of repealers. Could you just give me a high level what those repealers are? And I'm sorry, I missed the rollout.
So Senator Coghill, through the chair, AS 2605-170 is a relationship between the governor and TAG regarding control and command of the organized militia. We're looking at 2605-235. mandatory annual active duty training at sites other than regular bases. 2605340, use of organized militia against labor organizations. That's where we were moving it from one section to the other, okay. So that part's being repealed. And 2605340D, necessary regulations adopted by the TAG and approved by the governor. Again, that's another section we're repealing but reenacting in another part of the bill.
It sounds like all the authorities of those stayed in place, but they were just rewritten is what it sounds like.
Yeah, a lot of this bill is kind of cleaning up the statute at the same time.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Representative Tuck, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, and I don't know what was said beforehand, but this but pretty much what this is basically defining the command authority. So it's very clear, control authority and command authority between the governor and the adjutant general. And some of that we see right here, because as we go through, Title 26 hasn't been changed really since 1955. The first time was 3 years ago with the Military Code of Justice. And these are a series of bills to make it all flow evenly, make it all easy readable, and everybody understands what their roles are.
Okay, sounds reasonable. Thank you, Representative Tuck. Okay, if there's no questions for the sponsor or his trustee staff, let's. We do have Brian Duffy online at JBear, Admin Services for DMVA. Mr. Duffy, are you online?
Dropped off.
It's 4:30.
Yeah, maybe he might call back. He might hit the wrong button. Okay, let's see. I don't really show any. I don't show anyone else to testify. So, what do we do? So, the fiscal note's zero on this. That's what I was talking to Mr. Duffy about. But it does seem like we're adding some. Potential adding some, right? Yeah, well, section four, yeah, having to do with the disability and while on the line of duty, and perhaps they're not anticipating anyone getting hurt, and let's hope no one does. Has that been brought up at all, Representative Tuck?
Say Senator Meyer through the chair. We have a bill that's going through right now where the Alaska State Defense Force is covered for while they're on active duty status for workers' compensation. There's a bill going through that will add them on for training for the workers' compensation. That one is, I believe, House Bill 126, and that one also has a zero fiscal note, so that's been going through the process. And this is, as we're cleaning up the statutes, as I say, these three bills kind of really intermingle between each other. So this is the part of the conforming language that we were making sure is done between the bills. But yeah, that bill also has a zero fiscal note, as we already cover those individuals, and so we're really not adding on too much of their couple days of training.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. So, is this kind of a package deal? A package of three? If one goes, yeah, the other two are in effect, and vice versa. Go ahead.
I think it's a package of five, maybe six. How many is there?
Senator Meyer, there's three bills right now sponsored by the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, and then there's one that's also the Alaska Code of Military Justice Update. So there's four bills that are going through to clean up the statutes. We broke them up into pieces because it got real complicated when you had so many different issues that were going on. So that's the reason for having four of them.
Okay. Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just looking at Section 4, which you've been highlighting, the liability issue. But it also says, or community service. So is that also covered now, I mean? Or is this being added?
If I may, I'm corrected by my chief of staff. But right now, the Alaska Defense Force, they are... I believe they are covered underneath community service, but when they're in, when they're doing performing an active duty or training, that's where we're covering them in case they get hurt, because we're still obligated, but they're not covered underneath the workers' compensation, and it really costs us a lot more when we have to pay right out without having insurance coverage for them. And so this encompasses them for all those activities now.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Giesel. All right, looks like we do have Mr. Duffy online. Mr. Duffy, are you with us?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for the earlier technical difficulties. Brian Duffy from the DMVA, available for questions.
Okay, so I don't know if you've heard some of the discussion we've had. Some of it had to do with Section 4. Some of it had to do with the in Section 4 with the liability concerns while on inactive duty or training or community service. Do you anticipate any costs with that?
Mr. Chairman, Brian Duffy, Admin Services Director for the DMVA. The only cost we've seen to date with members of the Alaska State Defense Force being injured while in service of the state but not on state active duty was one instance, and I think it was a tort claim that was settled for about $50,000, maybe with additional fees for legal services to the department. So we don't anticipate a significant cost. It's a bit hard to judge. But what we'll be able to gain through the other legislation that Ms. Kloster mentioned is coverage for those members when they are in non-active duty status, but they are acting in service of the state.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Duffy? Yikes. We have a little technical difficulty ourselves here, Brian, right now. Okay, we're back, I think. Senator Coghill.
And maybe I'll ask the same question on the Section 2, just to help me. This is the where an organized militia may not be used to against or to mitigate a lawful activity, including an organized labor activity. And it was indicated that this would be you can't call the militia out to keep a lawful activity under control, but could it also be used to keep any organizational issue within the militia mitigated? So, what has been the process in law at this point? Because it sounds like this is just a rewriting of something we've already done. Can you help me with that?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, this is Brian Duffy, Admin Services Director. So to that end, you've seen other improvements covered elsewhere. The Alaska Code of Military Justice affords the Adjutant General and the Chain of Command opportunity to correct behavior, the likes of which you describe, which are counter to good order and discipline within the National Guard.
Is this the first time we've talked about organized labor as a lawful activity? I'm just curious.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, Brian Duffy again. So the intent here really is to ensure that it's codified in statute that the elements of the militia cannot be called in service to counter lawful activities that are being done in the state. It's the first time I've seen it, but my time in the state has been limited.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I'm just going to ask this. This is like the knucklehead dumb question. Do we have organized labor within our state militia anywhere? Mr. Duffy?
Did we lose Mr. Duffy? He's still on.
So maybe he's scratching his head. Yeah. I don't know the answer question. Mm-hmm. So... I'm just asking.
If I may,
yeah,
Mr.
Go ahead,
Chair.
Representative.
This section right here is dealing with any type of lawful activity that civilians may be performing, whether it's a demonstration, a march, or any other, and also any other lawful activity, including organized labor activity. I think we've seen in the history that in the past, especially in the turn of the century, the 19th century, that organized militia was used against.
I remember, Mr. Chairman, people putting flowers in guns at Kent State, and so what I was wondering is, would it ever be used to prevent organized labor from saying, "Well, we're flight line operators and we don't want to organize," and And, you know, I just didn't know if that was even within the realm of possibility within our militia.
And
so that was my knucklehead question.
Actually, that's a very good question, because in the 1980s we had the PATCO strikes. And at that time, I think the president said, hey, you guys will return back to work according to law and according to collective bargaining agreements. So I don't think that the organized militia was used, or any type of militia was used to enforce collective bargaining agreements or to force people to return back to work, because it is a lawful activity to not have to return back to work, but they did feel the consequences of being terminated as a result of that. So I don't know of any time in history where people were forced to return back to work. I can tell you that the Sherman Antitrust Act at one time had looked at any type of monopoly, including a loose monopoly in organized labor. And if you withheld or held back on commerce, that labor was considered commerce at one time, and so you could be jailed for not working. And then in later on, the there was an amendment to the Sherman Antitrust Act that removed labor from that, so that you couldn't use that as a means of forcing people to go to work.
I knew if I asked him, I would get a good history lesson. But the point that I was getting is there any organized labor within our state militia force? And would they then be in a cross-tension within the militia itself? That was my question.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer to that question, but I know that military, typically, and agricultural workers are exempt from the National Labor Relations Act.
Is that right?
Typically in Title 10 prohibited. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is Brian Duffy, Admin Services Director, with a point of order when you're able.
Okay, good. Yeah, we temporarily had lost you there for a while, Brian. I don't know how.
Thanks, sir, we're back again.
Okay, have you heard some of the discussion?
Sir Coghill, through the chair, there are no organized labor elements within the uniform portions of the organized militia. The non-uniformed, if you will, normal state employees, certainly there are bargaining units that govern them. And if by chance a member were to refuse his or her assigned duties, refuse to report, refuse to perform, those are matters that the chain of command would take up in accordance with the Alaska Code of Military Justice.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for. I didn't know what that tension within the organization would be. I appreciate the fact that we don't want to use the military to intercede in lawful civic activity. So, all right. Thank you. That's the answer.
Great. It appears like
I appreciate the fact that we don't want to use
muted.
It's a delay. Sounds like
it appears like that was changed. That section dealing with the organized militia was an amendment made in, was it Military and Veterans Affairs?
Yes. I think, if I remember correctly, we were just moving one section to another section, and then as this section moved, we wanted to make sure that including organized labor activity was still there. And if I may have Ms. Klosser answer, because she may remember better than me. Okay.
Senator Meyer, I think that's correct. We were moving it from one section to another, and then there was an amendment in the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee that pretty much just cleaned up the language a little bit, make it read a little bit more clear.
Okay. Good.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. That's where my eyes first fell when I opened up my books.
All right. Thank you, Senator Coghill. Senator Egan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going back. I was in the National Guard for 7 years, and it's sort of a militia. It's under the Adjutant General, under TAG, and I was a Teamster, and I was in the National Guard when I was deployed on the slope, and I was in radio in private sector when I was in the Guard, and I was a state employee working for DOT when I was in the Guard. What's the difference? Won't all this still be under the Adjutant General?
Yeah, through the chair.
So they have to follow their orders.
Yeah, so if I understand your question correctly or your situation, you were a Teamster as a civilian.
Right.
And then you were called into active duty.
But I was in the National Guard.
National Guard. Right. Which didn't require you to, but you weren't serving in the National Guard in the capacity of a collective bargain agreement with the Teamsters. Yeah, so that's a delineation, that's a separation right there. I think what we heard from Mr. Duffy is that that would not be allowed to be serving in any type of organized militia with a bargaining agreement. I mean, you're allowed to be a member,
okay,
and you're allowed in your civilian life. There's no limitations on you being able to do that in your civilian life, but there is limitations of that for right. active duty.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Egan. So there is a – I don't see that anyone has testified, and I know that some folks wanted to, so I'm going to leave public testimony open. But there is a letter in our packet from a Mr. Wood. I don't know if you guys have read that. Okay. Mm-hmm. And his concerns are that we're delegating too much authority to the TAG. Any thoughts or concerns about that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. There was a section that we had in the bill that was allowing the Adjutant General to act on behalf of the governor when the governor was incapacitated in any way within up to 72 hours. In case, for example, we almost had that situation with the recent earthquake out of Kodiak and tsunami warnings where the governor was about ready to board an airplane. If he wasn't able to be reached, we were given permission for the Adjutant General to act on behalf of the governor in his stead, because we may not have time to actually reach the governor, and if the lieutenant governor is not available, or there is a little bit of delay of saying that the governor is incapacitated and then swearing in a lieutenant governor. But a lot of people had problems with that section, so we went ahead and removed that.
Okay. Oh, Senator Egan.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just that adds another memory. The Great Alaska Earthquake, 64. The National Guard flew my dad from here to Valdez, and he went and was meeting with folks in Valdez, and the Adjutant General left to go to Anchorage and bring more people back, and he crashed in Valdez Sound. So it took the acting AG, Thomas Carroll, was in that plane when it was going back to Anchorage, and the plane crashed.
Wow. Any more history stories?
No, that's enough, Mr. Chair.
And if I may mention, that's the reason why we had that provision in here at one time.
Okay. So that's not in there.
Yeah, so it's not there anymore.
Okay. Okay. Go ahead.
And I don't know if Mr. Duffy would like to respond to that letter as well.
Mr. Duffy, are you online? We seem to lose you periodically.
Mr. Chairman, we're back online. Thank you very much. Yeah, we have you guys going in and out. Mr. Chairman, I would just offer one thought to the committee members. The changes that are proposed in this legislation, although they enhance the ability of the Adjutant General to perform command and control activities, at no point is the authority of the governor compromised. It remains supreme the entire time. Thanks, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Duffy. Okay. Is there any other questions at this time? Okay. Seeing and hearing none. Representative, I'm going to hold this till the next meeting. I know there are some folks who wanted to testify. I don't see that they've signed on, so I'll give them one more chance, and we'll go from there. Thank you very much for your time. And Kendra, thank you.
Thank you, committee members. Mr. Chairman, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. Okay, so with that, we will be meeting again Tuesday, April 10th. And we do have, I think, this is one of your bills as well, Representative Tuck. House Bill 1, Election Registration and Voting. And also we'll have Senate Bill 190, I believe it's Senator Bagage's Energy Efficiency. And House Bill 7, Mark Ballots. And House Bill 235 is the North Star Medal. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee this time, we'll stand adjourned.